that.
It's great here, isn't it? You come in and you sort of, you know, I was like, oh, John said he was nervous. I thought, I'm not fucking nervous. This lot don't scare me. And then just when Penny was reading that, I was like, bloody nervous. I feel like I want to go, wah. Right. I'd like to say thank you to John for his lovely chair. And especially, you know what, John, when you said, you know, you're a, I can't remember the words you used now, but you said you're a very lovely man. And I just thought, how many years it takes for us to say that in this fellowship and to really believe it, you know. It's a long old process, isn't it? And I think for anyone that's new, who is new here? I like to be a bit nosy. So if you're new, could you put your hands up? Lovely. Good. And that's just so, you know, I can see who you are and welcome you to this madhouse of people, of nutters, fellow nutters. You're in the right place. We have a lovely, colourful fellowship where we're all balmy, and somehow through our mutual insanity, we get well. It's fucking amazing. That's the other thing. I swear a lot. I must warn you. I think we're not supposed to swear, but, you know, me without swearing is a little bit boring. So excuse the profanities. I feel that I read a thing recently that said, you know, if you're intelligent and you say the F word a lot, that's quite all right. And that's, so I sort of feel quite justified now. And they did say that intelligent people swear a lot and walk around the house naked. And I do that too. Except I don't have a house, I have a boat. So I walk around my boat naked, except when we're moored next to, and then all the people can see in. So it's, and my partner says, shut the curtains, you exhibitionist. Anyway, we're going to get sensible now. So it's funny, though, because I've been around a while, and it's amazing how my head can say, coming in here can say, you've got nothing to say, you talk absolute shit, no one's going to listen to you. You know, all of that negative dialogue that really you would think after a certain number of years here it would go away, and it doesn't, you know. It's still there, it's still, you know, the propaganda still goes on. And I cycle a lot. So I was cycling today and I left the gym at lunchtime and the chairs started, you know, the chair in the head, oh, say this, say that. Oh, your God, they'll laugh at that one. Oh, yes, put that one in, you know, and all that. And it's just like, the more I know from my experience, the more I obsess about what I'm going to say, the more crap it's going to be. Do you know what I mean? And I've done chairs before where I've had like lists when I've been really in my control, you know, it's like little post-it with say this and say that. And actually, they're the worst chairs, you know, because really, to come in and just let my higher power do the job and me get out the way is, and my ego get out of the way. So I'm going to try and manage it. It's quite hard, quite a big ego. But well, I'm sure we'll get there in the end. So a little bit about me. I've been in the fellowship a while. My clean time is coming up near to the time I used. So I always imagined when you get to that point, you'd be incredibly spiritual, have all the answers, and almost be floating, you know. And of course, that's not me. I'm not floating. Some days I can be quite spiritual. Other days I'm still, for example, my cycling. You know, most days I'm really nice. I start off very loving, you know, nice, smiling, letting people in. And other days I can be like, you know, the woman possessed. You know, and I could be on the pavement, people could say, get off the pavement, I'm like, fuck off, you know. Just really, you know, and I think, oh, God. And the other day, someone chased me. I have a bit of a difficulty with rules, still. Red lights are a slight problem. I sort of feel special and different, and that jumping a red light. In fact, I love it. I love all of them waiting in their fluorescent jackets with their helmet, and I'm like, woohoo! And I go through really fast, and they're all like, oh, you know. And I had this guy chase me, and he said, what are you doing? You know, you give us a lot of bad name. And I was like, is it your fucking business to chase me down? Do you know what I mean? And I think I'd do it a little bit for the response, just to see how these people, you know, it's like terrible, isn't it? Anyway, it's good to come here and blow myself up out the water. And you know now, don't you? You know the reality of who I am. I can be really, you know, for example, so Last 2 weeks ago, my partner and I were fast asleep on our boat. I'll talk about the boat, so that's a whole new experience. But and in the middle of the night, we heard our neighbours screaming, "Amanda! Maxine!" And we came out, and the boat was in the... We were the other side. I looked out the window, and I thought, there's a tree there. That's really weird. That wasn't there when I went to bed. And this bloke, right, had come and cut our ropes. He'd come down, and all it was... The week before, a few days before, this bloke had come to moor next to us, and we weren't tied on to much because we'd had a little incident. We have quite a few incidences on the boat. And I'd said, I can't drive it anymore, we've got to stop here. So we'd moored, and we were only tied on with one rope. And he came and he said, oh, and moored next to us. And we said, we're not very happy, we're only tied on by one rope. And he went off. And then 2 days later, our ropes got cut, and he'd come premeditated. He'd come on a Brompton, fold-away Brompton, you know, fast exit, like, and with his knife, and cut all our bloody ropes. And it's very. This is the addict, right? The addict gets hold of it, and immediately I'm like, doesn't he know who I used to be? You know, it's like I'm not only gonna do his ropes, I'm gonna break all his windows. I might burn him out. I'm gonna get the boys in. I'll put him in the back of a van. Or do you know what I mean? And it's like 3 nights of not sleeping with the head going, how are you gonna find him? When are you gonna get him? You know, and it's like I'm sure a normal person would just. You know, and this is the life of a recovering addict, isn't it? Of having this very mad brain, and then you've got this sort of spiritual program bit that comes in and says, you don't want to do that, Amanda. You know, and then I'm like, right, we're going to confront him. We're going to get the police involved, you know, trying to go down the legal route. I was like, we've got witnesses. And then I'm cycling in the morning, having all these conversations with him on his boat. Do you know what I mean? Oh, we've seen you. We've got witnesses. And give us the money for the ropes. And, you know, and this is... You know, the reality of living with a mad addict head that I'm sure normal people, I'm sure they have these struggles, but for me it feels a bit, you know, I feel a lot of the time I have this head and it's quite out of control. And I would say that over the years it's got better, but sometimes I can think it, in a way it's, you know, it's definitely become more cunning and more the way the addiction comes in, you know, in terms of the behaviours is quite different these days. It's very clever. It talks to me in recovery language. It uses long words. It makes me think that, you know, that's a sensible decision. I was having a chat with my friend the other day. She's a social worker, and I was telling her about the ropes. And she said, I said, do you think I should go and cut his ropes? She said, yes, I do. And I thought, that's right, she's a social worker. And she said, I can. It's almost like green card. And I spend my winters abroad. And I was like, right, before we go to India, we'll find him, we'll cut his ropes, we'll do his windows, and then we'll go, you know. And it's like, I'm not going to do it. But, you know, I sort of get off on that. And it's and this is the whole thing of having this head that is very, very powerful and will run off in all these sort of mad tangents if I let it. And thank God for the program, thank God for my friends, thank God for my sponsor, thank God for meetings, so I can come here and share that stuff and realize I'm not just the only lunatic that has these mad responses to quite normal situations. And that's why I keep coming back, really. You know, this fellowship for me has been, I've never fallen out of love with this fellowship. I love us lot. I think we're absolutely amazing. You know, we come here, I came here with absolutely nothing. I had a good belt for banging up, because that's handy. You've got to have a good tourniquet, and a good shoplifting coat, which had all the lining, you know, all the lining went all the way around. So you could just put it in the pocket and then shove it round. And I had a little black bin bag, and that was it, you know. And my thing was that I really thought after a few weeks of being clean, I'd go back out there and earn a lot more money because I looked healthier and I could get away with shoplifting and the punters would pay more than a fiver, hopefully, because my tits had grown back. That was my one joy of recovery. Within the first few months, I had these huge... I used to be called Mandy Big Tits. I'd go to all these mad NA parties and dance my tits off, and people would just be like, your tits are huge! And And it was great. I used to say, they're real. These are recovery breaths. You know, people go, they're not, are they? And I go, it's great. And I do chairs. I go, this is what you get. You get and it was good. It was good, you know. And I think people in the beginning used to get me to do chairs just because I would talk about, you know, I ended up like in Brixton and on the streets, like lunatic out there, you know, and very, very mad, very psychotic. And we had all these creatures that lived in our bodies, right? But we weren't mad, we didn't have correct psychosis, they were real. And I used to do these chairs and talk about these things. I had names for them, they were called critters. And people used to get me to do chairs just because I was so off the wall, they'd be like, get that nutter in, she'll be great, you know. And I'd say, oh, I live in a bin shed on Brixton Hill and I ejected my neck, you know. And if it was a really posh meeting, I loved it more. It was like, let's get their jaws to drop, do you know what I mean? I'd be gritty and hard and, you know, and especially if I had a microphone, I'd start making funny noises and you'd hear all these, do you want to hear me picking with my 1 mil on my arm? And just, you know, just really quite scuzzy things. But again, I was like quite proud of all of that. And, you know, and I look back and I think, oh, bless me, you know. And it was like, I really wanted to fit in, but I didn't, when I go to the posh meetings in Chelsea, I didn't have the Volvo, you know, I had my using hadn't been a Grammar Charlie in the Porsche, you know, it had been sort of on the street doing what I had to do to get money. And I never ever, I remember my first boyfriend getting clean when I was 21, and at the time I was like living, it was like the raving days, you know, and I was living on this site, you know, surrounded by piles of money and piles of drugs. And he came back to see me and he said, Amanda, I was called Mandy then, Mad Mandy, Manic Mandy, Mouthy Mandy, it was just, you know, whatever with an M. And he came and he said, Mandy, you've got a serious drug problem. And I just remember laughing at him. I was just like, fuck's sake, look at this, I'm fine, you know. And you know, and I think a lot of us have that journey where it, for 10 years for me, it was great. I loved drugs. I loved the life. I loved the parties. I loved the madness. I loved the non-conforming. I loved the nuttiness. I loved the white. You know, we'd put on parties in the middle of fields. We'd have a 5-day rave and we'd be like, yeah, come on, let's stand on the haystacks and see if we can be amoebas. You know, it would just be wild and crazy. And it was lovely, you know. And when Richard came to me and said, you've got a serious, it's like, serious drug problem. I'm having the, you know, if you aren't out doing what I'm doing, you're a knob, you know. You should be selling drugs and having this high, wild life, you know. And I just judged him. He said, you know, I drink frothy coffee and go NA. And I'm like, oh, God, that makes me want to feel sick, you know. And I thought, if my life ever comes to drinking frothy coffee and coming to NA, I'm really in trouble, you know. And I judged. I thought you were a cult. I was like, weirdos, nothing. Can you imagine doing nothing? And it is that thing that when you come from, you know, my whole life and identity was around drugs. I came from a quite a middle class family where they drank a lot of alcohol. You know, all I knew was I didn't want to drink a lot of alcohol. My mum said to me, Amanda, have a cigarette, have a drink, but don't take drugs. And of course, that's the worst thing you can say to a teenager. I was like, right, where's the drugs? Give me loads, you know. And it went on, and I thought it was great. I didn't think I had a problem. I left home really young. I did everything. I remember my mum saying to me, you know, there's nothing left for you to do apart from get married. You know, you've done it all. And it was just, you know, I feel sorry for my mum, actually, because I did. Like John said, she really went through the wrunger with me, the ringer, the wrunger, I don't know. She went through something, and I did cause a lot of worry and a lot of pain. But I was too self-absorbed. What have you done? Have you wet yourself?
Yeah. Laughing.
Sort it out. Fuck
yourself laughing.
Dear God. This is what happens. He's got his ketamine wee bag down his head. He's trying to be discreet as usual. Blown it, John, blown it. You can't get any numbers after this chair. Anyway. Yeah, So it was all great, and then it wasn't great, and then it was horrendous. You know, 10 years of, oh God, and just the grind of having to get out, get the money, do the, you know. And I was a very busy little addict, so I didn't. I love the way I'm holding onto this microphone. It's like, come on! Right, and you know, and I'd get up in the morning, and I wouldn't go to bed. You know, I would have been awake all night doing whatever, and I would always, you know, I was a little earning. I was a little sort of, come on, let's go and do whatever. You know, I would do whatever. I've done, you know, I sold drugs for a very long time, and then of course you get to that point where you've got high on your own supply, and there are no drugs left, and nobody will bail you anything. So you've got to go and do all the other scuzzy little crimes. I was a prolific shoplifter that used to wear Afro-Caribbean wigs backwards and have like lines of makeup and be running up Oxford Street with my high heels on and all the security going, let's get her! You know, and I felt like I was in the Trainspotting film, you know, it was like at the beginning with Renton, like that. And yeah, I mean, I was, you know, oh yeah. And then I really hated it, and that woman came out. I used to do all the refunds as well. I'd start one end of Oxford Street. So I believe I personally put CNA out of business, because I'd start one end, go in there, shoplift something, nick CNA, refund it, shop something on the way out, refund it, and just keep going, and then next, and then... And all the shops did it. It was just like, oh, my God, you could earn thousands of pounds. But then they all got to know me, so the wigs came in, and it was like professional. You know, put your posh accent on. And I love that. I love the fact that we're quite ingenious and that we get quite clever at our crimes, don't we? We're quite... Oh, there's another friend of mine who she used to dress up as a nurse when she was doing kiting. And I thought, that's fantastic, isn't it? Out with her checkbook with her nurse's uniform. Only us lot would think of that, wouldn't it? And, you know, and then there were always greed for me. Making money was always a big thing. You know, money for me was a... You know, to have money, to have power and control over others, to have drugs, it was always very important for me. But it was also part of, you know, I'm a driven person. I've always been driven. I've always been driven, whether it's drugs, money, people, whatever. I've got this little, like, energy in me that likes to be busy and do things. And that energy actually has been one of the best things that I've transferred into my recovery. You know, I've been a busy recovering addict, and through that I've really created the life that I wanted for myself. And it's taken a lot of years, you know, to think about, first of all, to find out who I was. You know, the reality is, when I came here, I didn't know anything about myself. I didn't know what I liked, who I was. I didn't have a clue about my identity. You know, I'd started using at 13 and I finished using at 31, and I was smashed. I was, you know, absolutely broken. And the end of my addiction was horrific. It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't funny. It wasn't, you know, I was a working girl on the streets of Brixton. I would go and I'd earn my money and I would sell my arse for fuck all. And then I'd either get robbed or mugged by a fellow crack user, most probably coming down the hill to score. Or I'd shoplift and then someone would nick all my stuff. You know, it was just like, it was like a war ground, you know. And I really, I look back and I think, why did I have to go to those depths? Well, the reason I had to go to those depths, and, you know, I'm sure a lot of you haven't, you know, I lost everything. And I needed to. You know, the reality is my higher power knew that for me to lose all of that love for drugs and that arrogance. You know, I always thought I'm really intelligent. You know, addiction's never gonna get me. And you know what? Addiction does not discriminate. And I think my intelligence was a big barrier, really, for me, because I talked my way out of, you know, abstinence or not doing this thing for many, many years when I knew it was actually the only thing that would help me. And the last few years in Brixton were really, you know, I had moments there where I just, moments where I felt like I was about to die, where I had someone strangling me, and I remember coming round and he'd nicked all the money out of my bra, and then coming out of this bin shed and this other guy trying, just, I don't know, can't remember even what happened, but I just remember walking down Brixton Hill thinking, this is, you know, there isn't anyone that I could go to get a hug to tell me it's going to be all right, you know. And all I could do was go back down to the front line to get some credit, to get back to work and earn some more money, you know. And it was like, and then, and it was just like this endless, and I knew, in a way, deep down, there was that little part of me that knew there had to be something else, and that maybe you know, maybe there was another way, but I didn't believe it really. And I had a lot of drug workers, a lot of people trying to help me over the years, and you know what, I just didn't have it. I didn't have it in me for some reason. And then what happened was I had a succession of court cases and I'd breached probation, and I knew I was looking at a long stretch, and I had a fear of prison, desperate fear of prison, because I'd never been. I used to stand up in court and represent myself. I'd put on a posh voice and I'd be like, oh, I'm a drug addict and it's awful, you know. And generally, I'd get nicked in very posh areas and they would respond to the posh accent. And I'd get away with this. I have 53 convictions, you know, and I never went to prison. That's horrendous. I mean, they should have. I was a prolific offender. I should have gone to prison. I never did. So when I knew I was looking at prison, I thought, you know, I've got to sort myself out here. So I got into a detox just to swerve from prison. And by the time it came to court, and I represented myself again at 3 months, and the judge said, Amanda, you're doing very well. Go back to the treatment centre and complete. And I was like, yes, of course I will. And I did this treatment centre, and you know what, I hated it. I hated being told what to do and what time you got to be in and all of that. But I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know, and I didn't have anywhere to live. So it was like, if I walked from there, I was back out on the street. And I made that decision to commit. And I started coming to the fellowship, and I loved you lot. I loved you lot. I was like, they're mad. They're like me, you know. And I used to go to this meeting in Paddington where it was in a mental health unit, which was great. I felt really at home. And everybody had smoked loads of fags. We were still smoking in meetings then. You couldn't even see the other side. It was like so much smoke. And we'd have seagulls hitting the window and just dying. It's like, yeah, we're in Paddington, we rock. And then you'd have the mental patients coming in, you know, doing their little sort of unwell walk, and we'd be like, yeah, come and join us, you know. And I loved it. It was like, this is great. And we'd just talk about, we'd just war stories. We'd all share, it was a newcomer meeting. We'd all just share, look at my scars and all of that. And it was great, you know. And we'd go for coffee, and I couldn't even sit down. I'd be so excited with you lot's energy. I couldn't even sit down. I couldn't. You know, and when they banned smoking in meetings, that was hard. It was like, how do you choose between smoking outside or being in the meeting? You know, it's a big thing. And I used to drink so much coffee, I've got to say. I came in, and I think because crack cocaine was my drug of choice, you know, it was like, right, let's see how much strong coffee we can drink, you know. And it would be like drinking this coffee that was just the most bitter, disgusting, because it was so strong. They'd be like, yeah, come on, let's drink loads. And then there was the Red Bull, you know. It was like, oh, let's have 14 cans of Red Bull, see if we can get away with not having any issues afterwards, you know. And it was, oh, we were mad. We did lots of clubs. There'd be big gangs of us. We'd go out clubbing, let's go mental, Diet Coke and Red Bull and, you know, fresh air, you know. And all these people would come up and go, what ease are you on? We go, we're just on fresh air and Diet Coke. It was great, and I just thought, this is why I got clean, you know. And in a way it was, just to recapture that, you know, what I got into drugs, you know. I loved partying. I was like the party girl that went horribly wrong, you know. And when I got clean, it was like that part of me coming back, my spirit coming alive, you know. And I was talking to someone before the meeting about, you know, doing something where you feel most alive. And for me, that is dancing. I love dancing. Anyone that goes to, you know, give me a speaker. This is why my partner and I are both deaf, because we've spent our lives in front of speakers. Speaker stacks, you know, we're like, we have to tell it really loud. It's like we're like 70, you know, because we've spent over the last 10 years with our heads in speakers, you know, and then 10 years in. But anyway, you know, music's great. And what's happened for me is that in recovery, I've followed all my passions. I've followed the things that I've wanted to do, you know. And I sort of fell into working with addicts. Like this morning, it's very funny what happens in recovery, you know, because whether I like it or not, I have this like built-in conscience now. So it's raining this morning, right? And we're on the boat and I'm like, oh. And I work for, I'm funded by the National Lottery, and it's a national program to work with the most naughty, outrageously naughty, badly behaved people that cost the government lots of money. So you've got to either be a prolific offender. You've got to have lots of issues to come and work with me. And it's great, because I've got the naughtiest, the baddest, you know. And this morning I had to go and see this guy, and he's only got, his leg needs to come off. He's got a leg, if for any of you that know what crocodile does, right, that's what his leg looks like. I've never seen a leg that bad, you know. And I sat there, and I hadn't seen him all week, and I thought, you know, I didn't want to go to work this morning, and I thought, I've got to get up. My conscience, and because of who I am and what I do, because I was that guy, really, that had holes in my arms and holes in my legs. So I got myself to go and see him, and in a way, I knew it's, you know, as soon as I get in there, we have the 20-minute, come on, give me a tenner routine. And I'm like, I'm not giving you a tenner, I can't, I'm your worker, you know. And his room is just like, just an addict's room, you know, there's blood all over the walls, there's a sea of works, and there's the smell of his rotting leg, you know. And I'm like, you know, for me, I think we, as recovering addicts, are the only people that can really reach those people, do you know what I mean? And like, I said to him this week, I'm going to come and clean your room, I'm going to change your bedding, I'm going to make this room nice for you. Do you know what I mean? Because there's no one else who'll do it. You know, give me a pair of gardening gloves or whatever and I'll get in there and do it. And this guy, how he's still alive is phenomenal. And, you know, and I tried to do a bit of blackmail to get him to come and get his leg dressed. The nurse is in the building and then I go to see the nurse. Then the nurse doesn't want to dress the guy's leg because he's been so rude, you know, to her. And I'm just like, look, love, you know, we've got to be professional. That was last week. This is this week. This man's going to, the leg needs to come off. We need it dressed. Let's put our professional heads on. So, you know, my job is going to battle every day with social services, with NHS people, you know, to get these people what they need, you know. And I've learned to do that in this fellowship. And I've learned to do it now with a posh voice and my professional hat on. And I love what I do, you know. My purpose, my passion, from what came here really, from sponsoring people, is in my work. And, you know, and I think if you're new around, you've got to find what you're passionate about. You've got to find what gifts God has given you. Do you know what I mean? I believe we come here with certain talents and qualities and we are destined to do something. And I, you know, I've got my little niche. I work with young people as well and I'm great with them. I had one the other day who was like, get me a second breakfast, otherwise I'm going to kill myself. And I was like, Del, you can go and kill yourself, but I ain't getting you a second breakfast, you know. And it's like, and I just said, if you start doing that, I'm going home, you know. And it's like, it's like, you know, this fellowship has taught me to be everything I am, you know. And I was talking about goals at the beginning, you know. I came here with nothing. And what's happened over the years, I've had lots of crazy relationships. Oh, yes. And made lots of mistakes, like John. And we've laughed and shared many of our mistakes. And some of the things that man shared, I'd be like, oh my God, did he just say that in a meeting? You know, but, and I've done the same. And it's like, that's why we're still fucking clean. Because we've got honest. We've shared the shit that people just go, oh my God, you didn't do that. You know? And that's why we're still here. Because we, you know, there's no shame. Whatever you think you might have done, we've done it. We've done it. So what? Join the club. You know. And, you know, we are twisted, perverted weirdos. And that's all right. That's all right. Get comfortable with that. You know. And, I can't even remember, I've lost my thread now. Anyway, yeah, so I came here with not many aspirations of what I wanted to do, and what I did was just work. I went to work, I got straight, I got honest, I put down the benefits quite early on, and I started working. I've done no qualifications, you know, University of Life and all that, and just worked my way up my job, and became a manager, was on really good money. Now I've gone back to frontline work, because I love working with people that are, you know, that I can do what we do here. And, you know, and I've had some things where, you know, 9-10 years, I felt like I was having a breakdown. I was like, you know, everything I wanted to be took time to come here, you know, and I was very much like John, a very slow learner. It didn't come easily. And I've had a lot of periods where I felt like I'm really up against myself. And the things I struggle with is people not doing what I want them to do. that's number one. Like, you know, if you lot could do exactly what I want you to do all the time, we'd be fine. We'd be, life would be good. And the other thing I struggle with is sugar. Sugar is a big, and that also, you know, if you knew it, you think, weirdo, sugar. But wait till you've been around a few years, you'll see. Sugar is the new crack cocaine. If you haven't discovered that yet, try not to eat an almond croissant every day. I had my one at prep before we came in. You know, and... but what I knew was that I didn't like... I don't like that responsible, productive member of society, because I feel like that's a bit, it goes against my sort of rebellious characteristic, and I didn't, and I had a good sort of 10-15 years here working, doing the thing, bought a flat, paid the mortgage, and I just thought, and I got to that point where I was like, there's got to be something else. And then I got made redundant, and I made the decision with my partner to make that change, to take that leap of faith, and I went and did a yoga teacher training. And we have a house that we rent in Goa, and we made that leap. And it's like taking the show on the road. You know, my sponsor said to me a few years ago, Amanda, I'm so sick of listening to your step work. You have done so much step work. She said, just go and live the bloody program. And I was like, oh no, that's a bit of a weird thing for a sponsor to say. She just said, just go and live it. And I thought, she's so right. And we went off, we've rented our flat out, indefinite, and we came up with this idea, we're going to buy a canal boat. That's a great idea. We'd never even been on a boat, right? I'd seen my friends and thought, I love these people. These are like our tribe. We found our tribe, Maxine, I said to my partner. And we went off to Goa. I got a job as a yoga instructor. My partner does massage. And then we started looking online for a boat. And then we bought this boat online. We were like, woohoo! All our savings, and I was like, there is no boat. We've just, you know, that's what I thought. Because what I've realised is, over the years, I might have done all the step work, but did I have faith that the universe would really look after me? No, not really. I think I've done a lot of lip service in this fellowship where I've said, yes, I believe my higher power will take care of me. But on a deep level, because of my childhood experiences, because of my life journey pre this fellowship, I never, you know, I've always believed I have to look after me. I have to go out and get what I want. And this last sort of 18 months has been about letting my higher power in and trusting on a really deep level. And we bought this boat, and I'd done lots of visualization about this boat's going to be perfect. This boat's going to be wonderful. You know, I'd done all of this, and I was like, I'm going to get back to London. I'm going to find a perfect job. You know, so I'd done all of this affirmation, right, to ask the universe for these things. And we got on the boat. And it was perfect. It was like everything. You know, it had, like, I'm funny about my sleep, right? I like to sleep in a womb, like in a dark room, earplugs, you know. It had blackout things for the windows. It had memory foam mattresses. I'm funny about beds, got to have a memory foam mattress. You know, it had all, it was like my God had listened and sorted out. Or it really felt like that. And I'd done all this visualization about the job I was going to get. And then I started at this one job, and it was the worst job I've ever had the whole time. And this client abused me for a week, and I ended up standing in front of the managers saying, I've got to let him go, I can't do it. And they were like, well, why did you work for him for a week? And I said, because I thought I could help him. You know, and it was like the worst job, and I was like, God, I can't believe you did that to me. And then I got this other job, and it's been brilliant. It's been like the job is absolutely made for me. I just run around with this credit card. All my clients get a £2,000 budget, and I just go buy them things. I'm like sugar mummy. Do you know what I mean? And I was sat in probation with my client the other day. She said, oh, Amanda, you're like my sister stroke mummy. Do you know what I mean? She said, can I sit on your lap? I love you. And I just thought, it's lovely. You know, I work with these young people, and I sort of take them under my wing, and I do exactly what I've learned to do here. I 12-step them, really. But I do it in a sort of professional sense, you know, and I swear a lot, a bit unboundaried, but that's all right. And they respond really well. But it's just that thing of, you know, putting it out there and trusting that your higher power has got your back, and that your higher power will provide everything. It's just about having that faith and having that real deep belief it's going to be all right. And that's what I have from Narcotics Anonymous. I have that deep, you know, if someone cuts my road, whatever, you know, if I get back to India and our house is burnt down, it doesn't, you know, it's all right. I'm all right. As long as I keep coming here and hanging out with you lot. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.